This is Debbie McKinney, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to the poetry program. In the poetry segment tonight, we'll be reading from a book called Poetry. It is, a monthly publication from Poetry Magazine. This is from April 2010. One of the nice features of this book that I liked is there's a question and answer after each poet's contribution, and it gives you a chance to find out what the poem really means or what they were thinking a little bit when they wrote the poem. So I'll read a few of those selections as well. Our first poem is by Todd Boss, called It Is Enough to Enter. It is enough to enter the Templar halls of museums, for example, or the chambers of churches, and admire no more than the beauty there, or remember the graveness of stone, or whatever. You don't have to do any better. You don't have to understand the liturgy or know history to feel holy in a gallery or presbytery. It is enough to have come just so far. You need not be opened any more than does a door standing ajar. Question. Tell us more about this poem and how it relates to museums and churches. Answer. My favorite services are taizé services in which no one preaches or interprets. The goal, achieved simply through song and silence, preferably by candlelight, is to create an environment for the encounter with God. I may have written this poem out of my frustration after reading an inaccessible poem. I think a lot about poetry as architecture. Poems are spaces with entry and exit points, spaces readers inhabit. But so often, I can't get through the front door of a poem because the poet has put a big stone statue of a literary illusion or something in the front hall, and it scares my dog, and I spill the dessert I brought, and I'm too embarrassed to come back. This next poem is also by Todd Boss, and it's just a word or two placed randomly back and forth on the right side of the page and the left side of the page and sometimes somewhere in between. It's called Should Leash Laws. Should leash laws govern a canine meeting, their paws all over, instincts greeting? It's we who do the dancing, there lest our restraints ourselves ensnare. Over the head, between the legs, we tangle with our rules and regs. Like film in a projector's cogs, reclaim the lead, then blame the dogs. Question. It looks like the poem is designed to be mimetic of a dog's far-ranging attentions. How does this connect with reading poems? Cool question. The poem is speaking out against the liberal passion for rules, so it breaks some rules with form, even though it's one of the most strictly material and formal poems I've ever written. I guess I was playing with that tension, and I got a kick out of trying to tangle up the reader. Question. Is there a particular dog you have in mind? Answer. All our laws end up dogging us a little. Question. How did a film projector get into the poem? Answer. I needed a rhyme for dogs. Question. So it's arbitrary? Do you feel it's okay to use a word merely for the sake of a rhyme? Answer. Call it a happy accident, or consider every word on the trail of another, whether the spoor in the snow or sense or sound of some other association. Poetry is pathfinding, a maze we make up as we get lost in it. Hansel and Gretel's breadcrumbs led to birds, which led to a candy house, a birdcage, an oven. Was the oven arbitrary, or did the breadcrumbs suggest it? In this poem, the rhyme suggests did cogs, but the dancing pantomime and the leash winding and the role reversal all suggested film. Paragraph by Ray, R-A-E, Armentrout. Paragraph. Record-breaking thriller dance attempt. Wolfman Jack style DJ in the video game says, "This is Wasteland Radio, and we're here for you." You are here, maintaining detente between the voices in your head. Immediacy is retro, says Lytle. Nostalgic slash futuristic scene in which we can read the code. Green, flowing algorithms. We can almost slip right in. Question. Lytle, who is he? Answer. Lytle is the poet and NYU professor Lytle Shaw. We had an interesting conversation last fall in which he remarked that immediacy, by which he meant something like a presentation of daily experience, was no longer available to poets of his generation. It's my little joke to have included this snippet of our real daily life conversation in a poem. I used Lytle here as an example of one of the voices in your head, the poem refers to. I don't think it's important that readers know who Lytle is. I included the name because of the way it sounds in that line. Question. The poem mentions Thriller and Michael Jackson. What kind of music was in your mind, if there was any, when composing the lines of this poem? How does music mark the passage of time for you, if it does? Answer. I seem to mention music occasionally in my poems, usually popular music. I'm interested in why certain things are popular. I also mention movies and television. Record-breaking thriller-slash-dance attempt is a phrase I either read in a magazine or heard on TV. I can't remember which. The phrase struck me as somehow telling. Record-breaking and attempt are actually rather sad qualifiers to the dance and the thrill. They abstract the possible experience. Also by Ray Armentrout. Outage. 1. We like to think that the mind controls the body. We send the body on a mission. We don't feel the body, but we receive conflicting reports. The body is catching flak or flies. The body is sprouting grapefruit. The body is underperforming in heavy trading. 2. Reception is spotty. Someone, quote, just like me, is born in the future, and I don't feel a thing? Like only goes so far. Question. How far does like go? Answer. How far does like go? Poetry is full of comparisons and parallels. It seems to trust in resemblance. I like to discover resemblances too, but the value of resemblance and the empathy it provokes is rather starkly limited. Even twins or clones don't literally share the same sensations. That makes me wonder what makes a self a self. My poems sometimes revolve around a nagging question. The next three poems are by Adam Kirsch, and what he's done is used photography by August Sander, portraits, to be the inspiration of the poem. So I will describe the portraits to you first and then read the poem. This first one is Farming Family 1912. It's in black and white. There are a man and woman seated with two little girls, one a little older, standing next to her father, I assume, or grandfather. One seated between. Behind them stands a man holding something. Next to him is a woman. And on the far right is the tallest man of all with a mustache and hat holding a guitar. Not playing, just posing. And a spotted black and white dog lying at his feet. Farming Family 1912. The cruelty of the men when they're alone, the women's tiredness and resignation, do not get multiplied as you'd expect when the extended families collect, one day a year to get their pictures taken. It's not that any of their faces soften, nor that there's any obvious affection between the farmer's mother and his son. And only an idealist could see in this brief cutting from the family tree a symbol of the strength of rootedness. Three generations dwelling in one place, knowing how soon the root will lose its branch, cut down and hacked pieces in a trench. The only explanation that makes sense for the illusion of resilience that lights their eyes and makes them look at home is that with every added generation, buried potentialities appear. The son who poses strumming his guitar refutes his father's brandished iron cross. No more convincingly than his bare face proves that his father's beard is obsolete. Denying one another, they complete their likeness to the contradictory God who commanded us to multiply so he could manifest in every birth another of his attributes on earth. The next portrait is titled Kinetics Researcher from Vienna, Max von Hollenstein, 1930, another portrait by August Sandler. This is a man only wearing what we would call underwear. He is strolling with his left leg placed in front of his right arm up in a walking cadence. It appears that he is walking along a garden path, but the foliage is rather dark in the background. Kinetics Researcher from Vienna, 1930. Nakedness ought to be undateable, proof that the latest phenotype is made on the same plan as his original, who sauntered through the garden, unafraid. Even without the cotton pouch he wears as a concession to the prudery of viewers not evolved enough to share his unembarrassed objectivity, the willing detachment on his face would show, better than any clothes, the difference between the antique innocence that knows no shame and cultivated shamelessness. The final portrait is titled The Woman of Progressive Intellect, 1914. It is an older woman, I would say probably in her 80s, maybe even older, seated in an armchair, dressed all in black. I think it looks a little like leftover Civil War era clothing. She has long sleeves that are puffy around the upper arm and a black tie bow around her neck, tied in a big bow. She has a ribboned type of a hat on, and she's has her hands that look quite aged placed softly on top of a book. The Woman of Progressive Intellect, 1914. If it were not for her enlightened eyes, she'd be the witch that intellect denies, has ever walked the earth. The sunken jaw, the blunt chin like a claw-toothed hammer's claw, the stubbed and crooking finger, and the skin as stained and crinkly as her crinoline, would make a loving grandchild run away. It takes another kind of love to see how spirit, in its tactical withdrawal from aging outworks that are doomed to fall, consents to the bewitching of its shell as long as we can hold the citadel, where the progressive intellect has spent a lifetime plotting the enlightenment, the backward and the beautiful dismiss as mind's revenge for its unloveliness. Question: what led you to write poems about August Sandler's photographs, and are you writing more of them? Answer: I first encountered Sandler's photographs in my high school art history class, but I didn't start to think about them in a poetic way until I saw a Sanders show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 2004. The title of Sanders' multi-volume collection of portraits is People of the 20th Century, and they seem to offer occasions for thinking about many different aspects of recent history. As photographs, they are inherently elegiac, and the fact that Sanders was documenting Germany before and between the World Wars makes them especially pregnant with implications. I have a number of poems in mind that I want to write, and I hope it will turn into a longer series. Question: do you intend for the poems to exist independent of the photographs, or would they always be published together? Answer: I hope that the poems function independently of the photographs. In a way, the challenge in writing is to get enough information about a photo into the poem so that seeing the original becomes unnecessary. Seeing them side by side, in fact, I realize how I've sometimes changed details of the pictures or combined several different ones without being conscious of it. Perhaps knowing that the photo exists, that this particular person was documented at this particular moment in time, is more important than being able to see what's in it. The Word by Emily Warne. The word comes along out of the mountain every once in a while to chill me. Undercurrent of an unwillingness to believe all is well in early spring beside a molten river riven by sun. Its loud hush and glug through leafless aspens split by a gravel bar's pulled switch. A bull trout with fluorescent red dorsal fin eddies in a pool between a sloughed-off root clump and caved-in grassy bank. Last year's down trees, slash piles, busted garden gate. Heed me and hear my loneliness. Split by a desire to be known, by a crowd of solitaires, and by one word split. A raven falls out of the yellow flame of a willow, its wings purely black buff sunlight. It paces the gravel bar, lists into westerly sun. Wing flash, black luster, gone. It is hope that tricks, belief that when this now shines, that this now shines with or without us. Then why scribble the Veery's mid-morning martial song? Soon Rick will arrive to help burn wood piles. Gasoline newspaper cedar shakes to start the blaze in this emptiness searching for God words. The ones God hears when priests without shoes, without socks, and with their shawls stretched over their heads, arms out, make forts of light, their backs to the congregation, their faces toward the ark, the rock, their white wings so pure that this now is no more than with its barbells of silence, with its task of burning. Question. Barbells of silence is a striking phrase. It gives the sense of an enormous effort being applied to something that is impervious to or outside the realm of that effort. What did you mean to suggest by this? Answer. The silence of no God talking back to all those talking to it. The silence of the congregation. The silence of children, childhood awe, for what seemed like magical rituals, the silence of women whose speaking threatens the system of Orthodox Judaism and those it puts in power, the effort it takes to speak given that conditioning, the silence if I don't speak, the silence that precedes every poem, the silence of a dry spell, the silence of noon, the silence of forests and trees felled by drought, the silence I've created arranging nature so as to live in it, the silent weight of doing just about anything but write, the silence out of which the barbells of silence spoke, completing a poem I'd worked on for months, and beginning again the next silence. Thin Place by Devin Johnston. White ash, you wait for me, as I will wait for someone. But what skin feels the wind? What darkness makes extinctions? breaking down dusk and dawn, house records on horse scaffolds syncopate their hammers, brick dust drifts like smoke, tints of habitation withdrawn, hinges of habit undone. Question. The horse scaffolds put us in mind of Louis Zukofsky's Sawhorses. Horses who will do it out of manes. Words will do it out of manes, out of airs, but they have no manes. Are they kindred? Answer. In a literal sense, yes, as a horse scaffold consists of wooden platforms supported by sawhorses. I recently passed some in use on the south side of St. Louis. A small dusty crew was perched on them, taking down a wall and salvaging the bricks. Their truck blazoned with that great phrase, demolition salvage. Like Zukofsky, I was probably drawn to the animate possibilities of horse scaffolding. We even have brick rustlers in St. Louis. As I recall, Zukofsky's horses are a bit friskier than my own, but the echo of house in horse fits with the instabilities of the poem and its feeling of impermanence. Also by Devin Johnston, Static. Zipping your skirt, you rustle past, sand hissing through a glass, with the Bedouin snap and flash of static electric, sparks disturbing fabric. This morning's charge could rouse the desert fathers of Sinai over which I drowse. Question. Tell us about the desert fathers of Sinai. Answer. Well, as the line suggests, I didn't make it very far in that particular book. It's a slightly absurd or wry touch to bring up those ascetics and hermits in an erotically charged poem. While the speaker snoozes over its pages, the contemplative life, his love rushes to work. The sand, which keeps time for her, stretches out in vast desert tracks for him. And now a few poems that are featured by the poets that passed in 2010, in the front and the back of the book. Philip Murray, 1924 to 2010. In a cage of light, my shadow raged, pacing that narrow stage, until its giddy sides, striated with scars, shivered and slid his splintered gauge, where nothing bars, what nothing hides, once upon a white page. Poem by Robert Dana, 1929 to 2010. No tame field, this. And once, for one man, fallen irrevocably into rage, it broke against the ear. Still we live on its edge, its grain violently ripe, its clouds of birds passing, like dark phrases of some last benediction, continually over. Gisela Kraft, 1936 to 2010, translated from the German. A rainbow breaks out of thinness into the blue. A gull spans the bridge to the zenith and beyond. A human being sets one foot beyond the horizon. Abraham Sutzkever, translated from the Yiddish, 1913 to 2010. From my hometown near Vilna, her letter came. Her youthful grace can still overwhelm. She'd pressed between her love and despair some grass from Polnar. With a flickering puff, this near corpse, this grass, burned letter by letter, each letter's face. On the letter's faces, a murmuring ember, this grass from Ponar. In this grass, now my world, my miniature house, children play fiddles in burning rows. They play for a legendary conductor, this grass from Ponar. I won't part with this grass from my hometown. The good earth I've longed for will let us both in. And then from the Lord himself, I'll offer this grass from Ponar. And the last poem is by Jack Myers, 1941 to 2009. When the sun tilts back, wing to root, in a fierce sleep, the birds inhabit the branches like doubts. They soak in the dusk, rocking themselves into small blind possessions of the wood, and sing one note into the falling temperature. By dawn, there are black fruit hanging from the bark you think looks so much like anger. It's home. I hope you've enjoyed a little of the insight that the poets gave to their inspiration tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Debbie McKinney, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.